and welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is the 1st of April, Year of the Tux Medical Pad, to the Year of the Trial Size Death Bar, which is between pages 27 and 39 in the 20th Anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text, published by Little Brown & Company. Three announcements for y'all today. First, this section has a large amount of vocab that I have already put on the website for you guys' viewing pleasure. If you indeed do not know some of the obscure medical terms, especially in the later part of this section that David Foster Wallace likes to use. Secondly, we have an open survey, which is linked in the description down below. If you want to contribute to the show and can't monetarily, this is a great way to do that. We have a survey on how much time you like to listen to DH and I, what sort of books and series that you like, things like this, and this will help make the episodes more enjoyable to you all, so you can only benefit from taking the survey. Third announcement is that we will not be having a Thursdays with DFW episode so that we can all take a break and read the next section, which is between pages 39 and 55, and that is two Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment sections, as well as the October Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment section. And again, that ends on page 55. So to start off, we have 1st of April, Year of the Tux Medical Pad. This section is between pages 27 and 32. This is one of my favorite sections that we've read so far in the novel. We start off with something of heavy dialogue, and though we're more familiar with the characters than before, we do quickly find out, just by way of him, David Foster Wallace, telling us that Hal is here again, and Hal is actually 11 years of age. At this point, and there's another man that Hal is visiting who calls himself a conversationalist. Really, the heavy dialogue here functions in a way that makes it sort of mysterious. I really like this section because it reminds me of The Sound and Fury a little bit. There's a lot to deduce that it sort of makes you realize that we're missing a lot from just having so much dialogue. And if you think about it, you can't really accomplish that much with dialogue in a book. But David Foster Wallace, I think, does a really good job with mediating this heavy dialogue and the information that we're getting out of it. Here we also see that David Foster Wallace is incredibly particular about punctuation. I think this is heightened by the fact that we read things like intonation into the dialogue, and yet David Foster Wallace rarely uses anything but periods, ellipses, and the occasional question mark. And so even though there might be some bits of the conversation that are a bit more excitable than others, and we might read them in such and such a way, he won't use an exclamation point, for example, or a semicolon when someone is speaking. And I think that's just a really interesting way to sort of flatten the dialogue and also make it harder to pick through. So, this is the third year and the third time period that we've encountered. We know that Hal is younger, and we also know that himself, which is Hal's father, is still alive, and that CT, Hal's uncle, has not taken over yet. So in the first section, CT is sort of acting as the father figure for Hal, and we presume his other two brothers, Mario and O, as well, but he's acting as this really parental figure, and CT is not in the picture yet at this point. Another thing I wanted to note really quick about this section is the section has sound effects, so if you need another reason to continue with Infinite Jest, the sound effects are certainly one of them. The slurping sounds and the different popping sounds that Hal makes as he's offered a soda and drinks it in this section are really interesting to me. I think it makes it really fun, and I'm glad that David Foster Wallace included that. I think it makes the scene so much more lively. I have a quote for you on page 28. "I might have to burp a little bit in a second from the soda. I'm alerting you ahead of time." And this is Hal, clearly, talking. He has this same fastidiousness, the same oddity as before, so it's interesting to see him in adolescence acting out. And so the story of this chapter is that he goes to this guy who's a conversationalist, who we find out in the end is actually Hal's father himself, and he wants to talk to Hal, and he wants to sort of talk to Hal through the guise of this being a conversationalist, and they broach on, you know, a few subjects and things, but the conversation isn't very fruitful at all. They don't really get many places, hence the soda and the slurping noises. But they do talk about this thing, which comes up in the first chapter of the book, Byzantine erotica. What is the deal with this Byzantine erotica stuff? This occurred in the first chapter as well, and it keeps coming up later in the book. So I actually Googled Byzantine erotica, and the only references and mentions of it are in Infinite Jest. So it seems like one of these little quips that DFW wants to put in for us. And yeah, it's very interesting. You think of these like Byzantine creations of tile and of weaving and things like this, and then you just mix it, you make it erotica, is essentially what it seems like it is. There are a lot of different fan pages and things about this. There's a Reddit thread, a subreddit too. So if you want to explore that, you may as well, because it does come up again, just FYI. So the next section, the 9th of May, Year of the Dependable Undergarment. This section is only a page, but it's actually really informative. It's really interesting because the last section was not very informative for us, sort of hard to deduce the details. This one, though, is really cinematic. So we get this first glimpse at Mario, which it seems like Mario and Hal are rooming together at the tennis academy, and they get a mysterious phone call, seemingly early in the morning, from Oren, the third brother, who we heard about from the mold story in the beginning of the novel. I have a quote on page 32 to sum up the mood of the section. The light in the room was a creepy gray, a kind of non-light. Hal could hear Brandt laughing at something Kenkel had said, off down the hall in the clank of their janitorial buckets. The person on the phone had been O. And that's really all I have to say for this section. It's so short that you can get a lot out of it, but we don't have time for that. So, Year of the Deep-End Adult Undergarment, pages 33 through 37. What is the Year of the Deep-End Adult Undergarment, you might ask? Well, on page 33, David Foster Wallace gives us a big hint as to what it is. To say nothing of the arresting image of the idolatrous West's most famous and self-congratulating idol, the colossal libertine statue, wearing some type of enormous adult design diaper, a hilariously apposite image popular in the news photos of so many international journals. And that all goes to say that for some reason the Statue of Liberty during this time period is known for wearing an adult diaper. This section starts off in a really interesting tone. It's sort of this like newscaster, like article sort of style, like investigative journalism. And this, yeah, the way that David Foster Wallace introduces this tone here, it's really stark. It's a big difference. And it's sort of like, I sort of envision it like an introduction to a superhero movie, you know, like, on the day of blah blah blah, the Statue of Liberty was wearing a diaper, that kind of thing. That's just the way I read it. I wonder if you guys might have any differing opinions. You can tell me on our comment post if you would like, but that's how I read it. This section is also quite satiric. We're actually focusing here not on Hal, it's a huge digression from Hal actually, and we're focusing on Arab culture for some reason. Not that it's a bad thing to focus on, but it's just a very random thing that David Foster Wallace picks up. We have this Prince Q who eats only Toblerone. And he has these medical attachés that have to attend to him at most times of day because since he eats only Toblerone, he obviously has a lot of medical problems and he's quite important, so he can afford to have medical attachés and eat Toblerone. That is why this is satiric, by the way, is because he only eats Toblerone for some reason, and I think it's sort of a comment on not only high culture, but, perhaps assimilation, perhaps eccentricities, or perhaps our perceived eccentricities of people who we classify, quote-unquote, as ethnic, or quote-unquote, as other. So we focus on this medical attaché in the end. It's not on Prince Q, and I'm sort of between what our focus actually rests on, because this medical attaché is released for the evening. He goes home. His routine with his wife is normally that he would sit in the recliner, and his wife, who is also Arabic, will tend to him and make him food and all of this and all of this. It's so he basically sits in the chair and he's attended to when he gets home from work. But this time, when he gets home from work, his wife is at tennis practice. So she's not there to attend to him, and we can see immediately these difficulties that he has. And I'm wondering, where does the focus of this passage rest? Is it on the wife or is it on the medical attaché? Because it almost seems like this comment of when he gets home and she's not there is more of a feminist quip than a comment on him. I have a quote from page 36. The sideboard is against the wall opposite the room's electronic recliner under a triptych of high-quality Byzantine erotica. And this was my brain's way of saying, yes, this story somehow is connected with Hal through Byzantine erotica. I don't know why this is the only thing this section has in common with Hal's sections, but it is. So maybe you guys, if you have theories, you can also put them down in the comments. This section ends in a very anticlimactic way, in my opinion, compared to the rest of the chapters, and it's literally with this man who is bored out of his mind at home. He does not have his wife to attend with him, so he has nothing to do, and he starts searching through his mail. He finds an unlabeled cartridge in his mail, and he puts it in the TV, and that is the end of the chapter. The final section is the Year of the Trial Size Dove Bar, pages 37 to 39. This one is also amazing. It's so interesting, the diversity of sections and characters and plots and stories that we can get in this book. And this episode, I think, is a really cool, indicative episode for that. So another different scene is set. This scene is actually mostly in AAVE, or African American Vernacular English. I think that's a beautiful way to introduce this section. It's Faulkner-esque, again, sort of like one of the earlier sections, and it's so, so complex. So we have these characters, new characters, completely unrelated to the other two that we just noticed and mentioned. We have these people who are living in an apartment complex, it seems like, Wardine, Reginald, Clannette, who's the narrator, and Roy Tony, and we also have Wardine's mother. So this is a story we quickly hear. It's a lot of dialogue again. It's a story of abuse and about self-image and about relationships and family. So we hear that Wardine is being abused. She may be sexually assaulted by Roy Tony, and her mother abuses her. She often has these huge disfiguring marks on her back. On page 38, this is a recount from Clannette. Is she still pretty? She cry. That's Wardine saying, you know, am I still pretty after this disfigurement, after this sort of inhumane picture? And yet the story of the relationship between Wardine and Reginald is I think really touching and really beautiful. So this is a weird section because it's so short and because it's so lush with all these details, because also right after a page and a half of Wardine, Reginald, Clannette's stories, there's a complete 180 degree turn to focus on a completely different story. This time this story includes a focus on Bruce Green and Mildred Bonk. These are two characters who originally in this chapter in junior high, and it's their story of developing attitude with a capital A. So they become essentially juvenile delinquents and they sort of fall in love. It's sort of a misfit kind of story, and it's, again, really interesting, lots of action in here, very unexpected. And the most surprising part at the end of this section is that Bruce, Mildred, and their baby Harriet actually live with the man that weed-addicted older Hal relies on for weed. And we know this because he gave a clue earlier in the book that Tommy Ducey, who is the man who delivers the high-quality weed or, like, grows it, he delivers a clue that that person lives in a trailer with snakes, and that is the person that we end up with at the end of this section. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.